This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Suddenly, from behind the clouds, the Japs attack!
When America entered World War II, some of Hollywood's most celebrated directors enlisted and risked their lives, not to fight, but to film combat. We just heard a clip from the Battle of Midway, a film of the actual battle directed by John Ford, who already was famous for such films as The Grapes of Wrath and Stagecoach. Through the 1930s, Hollywood and the federal government were suspicious of each other. But after Pearl Harbor, the War Department wanted Hollywood directors to make short documentaries that could be presented in theaters before the full-length feature films. The goal was to show Americans what was at stake, give them a glimpse of what our soldiers were going through, and stir up patriotic fervor. Our first guest, Mark Harris, has written a new book about this unusual and unprecedented relationship between the government and Hollywood. It's called Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. Harris focuses on five directors who made movies for the War Department: John Ford, George Stevens, John Huston, William Wyler, and Frank Capra. He spoke with Terry last Monday.
Mark Harris, welcome to Fresh Air. This series of World War II movies with a lot of documentary footage gets started with the series Why We Fight, which is overseen by the director Frank Capra. He had a really great idea, which might seem obvious in retrospect, but it wasn't then. He wanted to work in Nazi and fascist propaganda films, use that footage and turn it against the Nazis and the fascists, and show how scary they were.
Yes, and part of Capra's idea to use Nazi propaganda films in the Why We Fight series was born of necessity. There was almost no budget for these movies. He had something like $450,000 with which to make 50 movies. So he was really on a shoestring. He couldn't go out and shoot a lot of stuff. But the Treasury Department had seized a lot of foreign propaganda movies, and Capra himself had also gone to New York and seen a print of Leni Riefenstahl's famous Triumph of the Will at the Museum of Modern Art. And he was so stirred by it and so stunned by it that he came out of the theater saying, "We're going to lose." And out of that despair, almost,
and Triumph of the Will
idea
is Leni Riefenstahl's documentary of a huge Hitler rally, basically staged for the camera. Very scary.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Triumph of the Will is propaganda, pro-Nazi propaganda, pro-Hitler propaganda, on a level of intensity that nobody in America had ever tried, because propaganda, even right after the war started, was still a kind of a tainted word, whereas it was not in Germany. So Capra's brilliant idea was to take some of these movies, which shockingly were shown theatrically in German communities in New York and in local movie theaters to pro-German audiences, and sort of turn them against their makers by showing just how dangerous and domineering these people could be. And the Why We Fight movies, which he framed as a 7-part depiction of what he called the struggle for freedom versus the struggle for slavery, was really a kind of combination of him being tasked to make these movies and of him coming up with his own ideology about the war and what the war was about before the people who were in charge of the war had ever really fully articulated it to him. So in a strange way, these movies, which were shown to every incoming soldier, made policy. They didn't just depict policy that had been dictated by higher-ups in the War Department. They were the first things to kind of articulate what the goals of the war were in a really clear way.
Let's talk about a movie that John Ford made during World War II called The Battle of Midway, which is the first film to bring combat footage to moviegoers on the home front. What did viewers see in this movie that had never been seen before?
Well, what was interesting about The Battle of Midway was that they didn't actually see the battle itself, which was rather spread out and diffuse. You know, Midway was an important strategic stop as its name suggests, you know, midway in the Pacific, an important strategic place for the Americans to try to hold. And Ford, who had been in Hawaii working on another documentary about post-Pearl Harbor rebuilding, and then was suddenly taken off the island, put on a ship, and taken to Midway without being told that there was going to be a major battle there. Ford was stationed on the top of a power station on the island early in the morning with his cameras and a couple of crewmen who also had cameras. They had a perfect vantage point to see incoming Japanese flyers in formation. The Americans knew that the Japanese were planning an attack. This time they were ready, both with planes of their own that were launching off of aircraft carriers, you know, torpedo squadrons, and with men stationed on the ground at Midway. So Ford was not in the thick of the battle so much as he was positioned in the doorway to the battle. He could see the planes coming in, and he could pivot around to the island behind him and see the bombs being dropped and the surface-to-air and air-to-ground gunfire.
Did he figure out ways to shoot these oncoming planes and to shoot explosions and, you know, planes falling out of the sky?
Well, what's so extraordinary is there was no time really to figure this out. Everything had to be figured out on the spot and on the fly. And also, filming wasn't, as far as the Navy was concerned, his only mission. The Navy said, we're putting you on the roof of the power station because there's a phone there. We need you not only to film, but we're really interested in you picking up the phone and telling us what you see as you see it. So Ford had to do that and film at the same time. And the Battle of Midway is not a movie of elegant camera angles or impeccable compositions. It's a movie of what Ford was able to capture and what Ford's men were able to capture, because a lot of it was not shot by Ford, and when they were able to capture it. And that kind of on-the-fly quality was one of the things that made it so real and so exciting to American audiences. What Ford famously did in the movie was he kept in a mistake. At one point, a bomb hit so hard and so close to him that the film in his camera was jarred loose from its sprockets. It looks like what happens when, you know, film flies out of a projector. And ordinarily, up until that point, that was the kind of visual mistake that a director would remove from his movie because it didn't make the movie look smooth. Ford kept it in, and the choice to keep it in was really the first moment at which battle realism was created for American audiences by a specific camera technique.
The Americans won the Battle of Midway, so what was the importance of this movie in the war effort?
Well, the War Department was, at the time of the Battle of Midway, desperate to give American movie-going audiences some good news. We were in the middle of 1942. The war for America was still, of course, in the Pacific, not yet in Europe. And the news hadn't been good. We were losing. We were rocked back on our heels by Pearl Harbor and had just begun to recover, and the valor of Americans until that point had been in stalling for time, holding off the Japanese for as long as possible in various engagements so that the Navy could rebuild its fleet. But at the end of those engagements, we would lose. Midway was one that we won, and Ford understood absolutely, once he had sat through the battle, that even though we also sustained terrible losses at Midway, and the emotional impact of that is something Ford carried with him forever, that the message of the Battle of Midway was that we were going to take it to the enemy and that we were going to win, and that that message had to get out to as many people as possible. Ford was so concerned about doing it right that he essentially took his footage and refused to turn it over to the War Department. He basically had it edited in secret, and that wasn't just because he was controlling or egotistical. It was because he knew how important the message was, and he really believed that he knew how to convey it better than any Army functionary or Navy functionary would.
I think this is very moving. He made a separate short film about the loss of a torpedo squadron, a squadron that was lost in that battle. And he made it on 8mm film. And he, if I understand it correctly, it was made for the families of the men who were lost. And he gave them copies. Do I have that right?
Yes. Before the Battle of Midway started, just in the days before the Battle of Midway started, Ford, for a while, did not know what he was there to shoot. He shot some fun nature footage about Midway. He thought that maybe what he was being asked to do was to depict, you know, Navy life on a remote Pacific island. And he shot some of the men of this torpedo squadron who were just laughing and joshing and proud of their planes. And he shot them, like, standing next to their planes and pointing to what they had painted on their planes and hanging out on the deck. It turned out that one of the squadrons he shot sustained the worst losses in the battle, and all but one of the 30 young men in the squadron were killed. That, for Ford, was his immediate experience of the battle. The news that it was a major American military victory drifted back to Midway Island slowly in the days after the war, but the first thing they understood was this terrible loss. And so after making the Battle of Midway, Ford compiled the footage of these young men that he had shot into a kind of memorial reel for the families, and he put it on a film that would be accommodated by the kind of inexpensive home movie projectors that were available at the time. He really wanted the families to be able to see it, and he had it hand-delivered to each family.
That's such a beautiful gesture.
And by the way, it was not made public for decades. That little film, Torpedo Squadron 8, was not seen until long after Ford was dead.
Another director that you write about is George Stevens, who had just an incredibly horrifying experience. He was there when the concentration camp Dachau was liberated. How did he end up being there when it was liberated?
Stevens' journey through the war is, in a way, a journey into the darker and darker recesses of the war. He started out by getting sent to the North African campaign and got there too late to film anything, and spent much of the war incredibly frustrated that he was far from the action. But starting really with the march toward the liberation of Paris, he was really in the thick of the action and filmed a lot, and was around for the Battle of the Bulge, and then was among the first Allied camera crews to get into Germany, as it was clear that Hitler was going to fall and the war was going to end. He had been to a camp already called Torgau and had seen enough destruction to realize that the atrocities that were being committed in these camps were far beyond what he or most of the people in the army or most of the people at home had ever heard about. But when he and his crew went into Dachau, it was, I think, absolutely a shattering and life-altering experience for him.
Do you want to describe some of the things he found there?
What Stevens filmed at Dachau was so painful that he didn't talk about it for decades afterwards. But what we think of now as some of the images of Holocaust atrocity that are burned into our collective consciousness, that's what Stephen saw. Bodies in boxcars, starving, dying, skeletal people, bodies covered in snow, body parts, crematoria, the worst things, you know, the worst things that we know of what the Nazis did in the death camps and the concentration camps were news to Stevens and his men, and of course to America when he discovered them. They imagine walking into Dachau not knowing what a death camp was, and seeing what he saw. So he did the only thing that he could do, which was to record it. At that point, he was no longer interested in making a documentary. What he was doing and what he knew he was doing from the first hour he was there was gathering evidence.
And that's how it was used. I mean, you couldn't very well show this footage to theatergoers. It was much too graphic and horrifying, especially for that time. I mean, the standards and what you could show in a theater was very different than it is today. But it was just too horrifying. But tell us how that footage was used.
Well, what's remarkable is that Stevens didn't flinch from filming anything he saw. I mean, the roughest stuff he filmed himself, and the footage that he shot proved to be extraordinarily important in the Nuremberg trials, where it was compiled into two evidentiary movies, one of which was specifically designed to show Nazi atrocities, and the other of which was designed to prove that this had been a long-term plan on the part of the Nazis, essentially to prove intent. Those movies were shown at the Nuremberg trials, and the defendants were forced to sit there and watch them. And many people feel that they were essentially turning points in the trial, in that not in that these guys were ever going to be found innocent, but in bringing home just how horrible what they had done was. Famously, a couple of lawyers, German lawyers for the defendants, said that after seeing the footage that Stevens had compiled, they couldn't even stand to be in the same room with their own clients.
How did this exposure to the death camp and Dachau change George Stevens' life?
I think initially it plunged him into a terrible depression. Stevens suffered his own form of what we would now call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. He came home, he was depressed, he couldn't think of very much he wanted to do. He went to parties and he spent time with his family, but he started drinking heavily. Two of his fellow directors, William Wyler and Frank Capra, had convinced him to go in with them on a new independent filmmaking company called Liberty, but he couldn't find a project to do. It was not until 3 years after the war that Stevens was able to even sit himself down and get behind a camera and make another movie.
Mark Harris, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Mark Harris speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Harris is the author of Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Poems about the death of his father are followed by poems about the birth of his son in Kevin Young's new collection, Book of Hours. We invited him to read and talk about some of his poems. He's the author of 7 previous poetry collections, including Ardency, a chronicle of the Amistad rebels, and Jelly Roll, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's also edited 8 books of poetry, including The Art of Losing, Poems of Grief and Healing, Jazz Poems, Blues Poems, and Giant Steps, The New Generation of African-American Writers. His collection of essays, called The Gray Album on the Blackness of Blackness, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Young is a professor of creative writing and English at Emory University. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Kevin Young, welcome to Fresh Air. How far apart was your father's death and the birth of your baby?
About 2 years.
And how did you decide to use those two incidents in your life, one tragic and one beautiful, as the anchors of your book?
Well, they were sort of the anchors of my life in a way. So it was a way of just writing about what had happened and also the way that the cycle of life informed my life from death to birth to, in a way, a kind of rebirth that I felt afterwards.
Well, I want to have you read a poem about the aftermath of your father's death, and this is called Charity. And if you'd like, you can introduce it for us before you read it.
Yeah, this poem is called Charity, and it's a poem about all this kind of aftermath, as you said, of his death. And all the daily things that seem so important and then also seem so unimportant, things almost flip-flop for you. And it's about trying to sort of track down his dry cleaning. Charity. So many socks. After the pair the undertaker asked for, I picture them black beneath the fold in your open casket, your toes still cold. What else to do? Body bags of old suits, shirts still pressed, long johns, the unworn, unwashed wreckage of your closet. Too many coats to keep, though I will save so many. How can I give away the last of your scent? And still, Father, you have errant dry cleaning to pick up. Yellow tags whose ghostly carbon tells a story. Where to look? One place closed for good, the tag old. One place with none of your clothes, just stares as if no one ever dies, as if you are naked somewhere, and I suppose you are. Nothing here. The last place knows exactly what I mean. Brings me shirts hanging like a head, starched collars your beard had worn. One man saying sorry, older lady in the back saying how funny you were, how you joked with her weekly. Sorry. And a fellow black man hands your clothes back for free. Don't worry. I've learned death has few kindnesses left. Such is charity, so rare and so rarely free, that on the way back to your emptying house, I weep. Then drive everything, swaying, straight to Goodwill, open late to live on another body and day.
So, reading that poem, I kept thinking about why you'd want to track down your father's dry cleaning after he was dead. Why did you feel that that was important?
I think I wanted him to be whole again, you know. Obviously, I couldn't have him here again, but I wanted all those parts of him. I mean, almost like Osiris or something, gathering all those pieces of the dead and putting them back together. It seemed somehow important, if only for the act. And then, of course, I gave him right away. And that was kind of also another point, to have them live on a bit like we all wish our loved ones who are no longer with us might.
Well, in addition to giving away his clothes, you gave away his organs. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of your poem, Solace. And I'm going to ask you to read the excerpt about donating his organs.
Okay. Yesterday, I had to phone her, my lover, calm as I could, and say above the static that my father was gone, but not quite. First, I must give his body breathed for away. Hello, this is Sarah. We harvested your dad's liver, which tested fine. This morning, it went to a 26-year-old who needed it. One kidney went locally. It was a match. The other, I'll know tomorrow. Do you authorize the skin? Yes. The lungs? Yes. The heart? Yes. The epidermis? Yes. The bone? No. The small intestine? No. The cornea? Yes.
Do they ask about the small intestine? Do you just decide not to give that, or is that?
They ask about everything.
So how did you decide the no with the small intestine?
I don't know. I'm only laughing because I can't remember, you know. It was so intense a moment, you know, and one doesn't, you know, I wish I could answer better that one.
Do you know if he wanted his organs donated?
I do. My father, you know, was the first in his family to go to school, and he went all the way to become a doctor, you know, and so I think that was very important to him. He was an eye doctor, a surgeon, so the cornea seemed really important. And, you know, I felt like it was going to live on. I think he would have wanted that, and I didn't have any doubts about that. It was didn't make it any easier.
Your book is called Book of Hours, and the final poem in your book is titled Book of Hours. So I want you to explain first what a Book of Hours is.
Well, I realize that it sounds like O-U-R-S, like our book, which I actually kind of love. But it also is, you know, a book of hours, H-O-U-R-S, which is, you know, a little devotional book people would have made. And people probably know them from their beautiful illuminated letters. And they have this kind of intimate quality, though, of prayer and psalm. And I wanted to really capture that kind of intimacy, but also that almost more literal meaning of hours and days and moments in the process of grief and joy.
So I'm going to ask you to read from the final part of the title poem Book of Hours. But before we do, I want to say the first time I read this poem, I was worried you were dying.
Oh, no.
Yeah. That's probably not the reaction you wanted me to have, right?
No, I didn't. But, you know, I suppose it's about risk. I don't know. For me, it's more about resurrection. Maybe you have to go through that first phase in order to find that rebirth phase. But it has this quality. I mean, in the beginning of the poem, I say, what good are wishes if they aren't used up? And for me, that was really some kind of motto toward the end of the book and the end of that process, I suppose.
So would you read the end of this for us?
Yeah, this is toward the end of the poem. And the beginning part is imagining what's a beloved, the you in the poem, who's both real and imagined, will think or feel upon learning that the speaker has died.
Yes, you can see why I thought you were dead. Not dead, but dying. You can see why I was worried
about
you.
Well, we're all, I suppose, you know.
Yes.
But no, only in that way.
Okay.
Other arms will lift you up, I know, carry you crying to my grave. The weeds and weather will sing my name. Look away. Let them let me down without you watching. Sunflowers, their heads seek the sun, or bend without one, even after cut, angling in the water toward what brightness we borrow. It's death there is no cure for, life the long disease, if we're lucky. Otherwise, short trip beyond and below. Noon, growing shadow. I chase the quiet round the house. Soon the sound, wind wills its way against the panes. Welcome the rain. Welcome the moon's squinting into space. The trees bow like priests. The storm lifts up the leaves. Why not sing?
You know, most of our conversation has been about grief, with poems about grief. So, like, why not sing doesn't seem to be a bad note to end on, and an interesting note for your book to end on.
Yeah, I mean, I think, for me, if anything, it's a bit like the end of Whitman in the sense of the same wish. You know, he's imagining one day I'll be part of the grass and look for me under your boot soles, that will be somehow redemptive. And so, I don't know, singing is the closest I can come to that feeling of not a song just of the self, but of, you know, why not sing now? Why not raise our voices in praise or however we think of it. And for me, that was really the end of the book always. I was glad it made it there.
Well, Kevin Young, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Kevin Young speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Young is the author of a new collection of poems, Book of Hours. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley in for Terry Gross. Last summer, four alleged leaders of rival prison gangs worked together to coordinate a hunger strike at California's Pelican Bay State Prison. It was in protest of long-term, indefinite incarceration in solitary confinement, and each of the four men was in solitary when the strike was launched. One of them, Todd Ashker, has been in solitary for more than 20 years. On the first day of the strike, 30,000 prisoners refused their meals. The story of how the four prisoners coordinated the hunger strike, and the larger issue of how solitary confinement has become a more long-term and widely used punishment in the past three decades, are the subjects of an article in New York Magazine. It's called The Plot from Solitary, by our next guest, Benjamin Wallace Wells. He's a staff writer for the magazine and spoke with Terry last Thursday. Pelican Bay is a supermax facility that opened in 1989. There are over 1,000 isolation cells in its secure housing unit, which is known by its acronym SHU, pronounced as SHU.
Benjamin Wallace Wells, welcome to Fresh Air. Until reading your article, I thought of solitary as this temporary punishment for, you know, a crime committed, an assault, whatever, in prison, and that you're there for like a week, a month, a few months. Right. But that was it. But reading your article, I got a very different sense of that. Can you talk a little about the amounts of time that prisoners today are held in solitary confinement?
Many of the men who I spoke with had been in solitary confinement, or conditions that we think of as solitary confinement, for 25 years. They are in a cell that's 11 foot by 7 feet, 23 hours a day. They are taken out of their cell for 1 hour, where they go to a concrete room where they exercise alone, and then they are brought back. They are fed through a slot in the door. Other than staring out at the same blank wall with seven other inmates, so they're in a sort of a pod, a group of seven cells. They can't see the seven other inmates, but they look out at the same blank wall. They have virtually no social interaction at all. They're never touched by another human being except to be put in chains or taken out of chains. There's no programming for them. They don't eat with other inmates. They don't take classes with other inmates. With the exception of that 1 hour a day that they spend exercising, they are entirely alone in their cell. It's a pretty extreme form of isolation.
What did you want to write about the hunger strike organized by prisoners in solitary confinement in Pelican Bay?
There were two reasons, I think. The first was simply the scale and coordination. On July 8th, 30,000 people around the California state prison system, 30,000 inmates, refused food on the same day. That was in protest of the policy of indefinite confinement in the SHU at Pelican Bay. It had been organized by people who were housed in those conditions. And so just the simple fact that you could have such a vast protest organized from such restrictive conditions was incredible to me. Some of those men, including the leaders, stayed on hunger strike for 60 days, which is really pushing death by everything we knew about the medical impact of hunger strike, of self-starvation beforehand. The second thing is, to the hunger strike leaders and their advocates themselves, this was a pure human rights protest. It was men who were at the end of their rope, who had been stuck in inhumane conditions for decades, who were taking control of the one means of expression that they had, which was to deny themselves food, as a way of calling attention to their conditions and as a way of generating a political movement. But to the prison officials and to many people outside, this was something very different. It was a tactical gang activity. They saw these men as leaders of prison gangs, and they thought that the conditions that they had put the prison gang leaders in had effectively made it much more difficult for the prison gangs to operate. And they thought, these are gang leaders who are using the language and methods of human rights protest in order to regain an ability to operate as gangs throughout the prison system.
You interviewed one of the leaders of the hunger strike, Todd Ashker, who's an alleged leader of the Aryan Brotherhood in Pelican Bay Prison. And this is a white supremacist prison gang? Am I describing that correctly?
Yeah, I think white supremacist prison gang is fair.
And he does have swastika tattoos on his body. So why is he in solitary?
Todd Ashker is in solitary because he was validated, which is the formal administrative process that California offers, as a member of the Aryan Brotherhood many years ago in the early 1990s. Todd had originally been in prison for burglary, but when he was in his early 20s, he killed another inmate in the inmate's cell. He stabbed him 26 times. The guy who died, the victim, was also an alleged member of the Aryan Brotherhood, and the prison officials and prosecutors said that this was a gang hit, that the man who Ashker killed had been cutting the gang out of proceeds from methamphetamine deals he had been arranging on the outside. Ashker himself said it was self-defense. Todd is an incredibly charismatic, intense individual. He's 50 years old now. He has a handlebar mustache. His upper body is covered in white supremacist tattoos. He's got 3 swastikas on him, all of which he got in prison. He is self-taught, politically radicalized.
And he got his paralegal certificate in prison, sued the prison system 15 times. What for?
For everything from personal injury, being shot and then being poorly treated, to the prisoners being denied access to the prison law library in the way they were supposed to be. He sued the prison system over what was at the time a no-warning shot policy, where prison guards could shoot prisoners without firing a warning shot effectively. All range of small and large violations. I think the interesting thing for Todd about those lawsuits is that the law gave him something to sink his mind into.
So explain some of the reasons he had for organizing the hunger strike.
Todd had been politically active in his own head. He'd been developing as a kind of political thinker for a very long time. In 2006, prison officials at Pelican Bay reorganized the SHU. They reallocated the prisoners into different spots in the security housing unit. They thought that the gangs had found ways to work even within these extremely isolated environments. Gang leaders had ended up housed next to gang lieutenants, and they wanted to break that up. And so what they did effectively was they took all the people who they thought were the most influential, of whom they were the most scared, and they put them all together in one small part of the SHU it's called the Short Corridor. And the theory was you would separate the guys who were very heavily monitored, who had a great deal of difficulty getting mail out, from the guys who had become accustomed to doing their bidding, the more junior players. But one thing that this did effectively was it brought all of the most senior and most influential men in the prison system into physical proximity with one another.
Well, how can that be? Because they're in solitary. So how are they in physical proximity?
Right. Okay. So it's because of the pod. Every cell in solitary is part of a pod of 8 cells. And though the prisoners don't see each other, they can shout to the people in those other 7 cells. Also, when prisoners are ingenious and they have figured out how to shout through toilet drains in their own cell to people in other cells in nearby parts of the prison, they figured out, you know, how those drain networks go.
So, like, acoustically, the drains
reverberate in certain predictable ways. And over many years, they've figured out, you know, how to use those to communicate from one pod to another. So, though it's enormously difficult for these men in the SHU to communicate with each other, it can happen. You know, there's a guy I talked to who's a former member of the Aryan Brotherhood who has what's called debriefed. He's formally quit the gang. And I talked to him and he said, you know, the members of the Aryan Brotherhood would sometimes take votes on whether to admit a new member, on whether to have somebody killed. And even though all of the members of the Aryan Brotherhood, all the people who are voting, are housed in this environment, we could conduct the votes. He said it sometimes took us 6 months to do it, to circulate those yeses and noes around the Short Corridor. But they did happen.
So the alleged prison gang leader sharing the pod in solitary decided to organize a hunger strike. 30,000 people, 30,000 prisoners initially join with them. How do you get the word out to that many people when you're in solitary and you don't really have a means of communicating with other prisoners or with the outside world?
It's an astonishing story, and a lot of this is still ambiguous, and this is where I do think the gangs probably did play a role. But what the hunger strike leaders will tell you is that they wrote letters, and though they are censored, many do get through. And they wrote handwritten letters to an activist website. And the prison activist groups, particularly in California, are pretty well established, and they distribute their materials throughout the prison system. And they said, here are our grievances. We think this is torture. We feel like we're never getting out. We've been here for so long. We think this policy is inhumane. And we're planning on hunger striking. And here's the date on which we're going to start. Now, when you talk to members of other gangs and former members of other prison gangs within the California system, they will sometimes tell you that when they saw those letters with those names, they knew those four hunger strike leaders not necessarily as political or human rights figures, but as gang leaders. And so they will tell you that they took that as a order from gang leaders that they were expected to participate. So there's some combination here of above board, transparent political communication that gets through to these activist groups, which then publish newsletters that are distributed to prisoners, specifying what's going on, explaining what's going on, combined with some below board gang communication. And the prison officials will tell you that they saw messages about the hunger strike, political messages moving out from the SHU in the same manner and through the same connections that gang communications tended to.
What did the hunger strikers accomplish? Did they accomplish anything in the 59 days that they refused food?
I think they did help to elevate this issue. One of the things we've seen over just the last couple weeks is that there's been a little bit of a rolling back, maybe a little bit of a reconsideration of solitary confinement nationally. At a hearing in the Senate on solitary confinement conditions, New York State has agreed to, just in the last couple weeks, has agreed to change, to modify, to liberalize its policy. In California itself, there's now a bill before the state legislature that would cap the amount of time that anybody can be kept in solitary confinement indefinitely at 36 months, which is, you know, a fraction of what many of these men have spent there.
Are the leaders of the hunger strike still in the same cells and still communicating with each other?
Asker has been moved away from the others. Asker was the public face of this thing more so than the other three prisoners. He was taken to a cell where he's in a pod with seven other guys, none of whom is white, and many of whom speak only Spanish. When I saw him, he complained to me about his mattress. You know, the man is passing into his sixth decade of life, and when he moved into this new cell, he was given a mattress on which he just couldn't get comfortable. It was too short. He sunk into, all the padding sunk to the outsides, and so he's sleeping on this plastic sleeve on a stone bench in a trench in the middle of the mattress. And, you know, he told me when I saw him that he was fixing to go back out on hunger strike, you know, just as soon as he could get, you know, the legal work done for the force feeding order. He was angry. He was ready to go again. And listening to that and just sort of seeing this anger in him, you do realize that your life in these circumstances is so controlled that any little thing can push you over the edge. And in the case of some of the other hunger strike leaders, that might have been having their mail messed with a little more than was usual. Or one of the other hunger strike leaders had a petition to donate a kidney to his sister denied. His sister was dying at the time. But the control is so absolute that your mattress can kind of send you over the edge. From the outside, it seems sometimes that, you know, looking back, this was an effective protest. They won quite a bit. From the inside, I'm not sure that it feels that way.
One of the things that surprised me in a way was the will to live. And I assume that in spite of the 59-day hunger strike, that the alleged leader of the Aryan Brotherhood in the Pelican Bay prison, who you interviewed, wanted to live. I know he was going to be force-fed if he didn't stop the hunger strike, but I'm assuming he wanted to live, even though he knew that meant going back to the conditions that he was on a hunger strike for and was willing, he was willing to die on that hunger strike. Did you talk to him at all about the will to live when your life has been unchanged for decades in like a very small room, not able to see anybody?
Of course. Each of the people that I talked to who were in the SHU now or have come out of the SHU dealt with it in different ways. Todd Ashker, the man you're talking about centrally, it seemed to me that he really thought about this as work. He had come to, over a period of years, think that there was something left in his life that had tremendous meaning, which was he could improve conditions for all of these people. He could change the consciousness of all of these prisoners. And he said to me, you know, if I think too much about the past or I think too much about the future, it gets really depressing. He said, I look at it as my life has been a waste. But what you can do, he said, is you can exist pretty terminally in the present, and you can continue doing work. And, you know, even though there's a sort of dimming, you know, there's a sort of a limitation of all kinds of stimuli, intellectual stimuli, emotional stimuli, they do exist. And, you know, I spoke with a prisoner who's been in solitary in Ohio for years and years and years, who told me a story about finding a blade of grass that, like, drifted down through the grate that covered his exercise room and keeping that under his pillow for months and just looking at it and thinking, there is a living world out there. There are men in Pelican Bay who would keep frogs alive in their toilets for months and months by giving them tiny bits of food that frogs crawl up through the drain pipes. So I don't know about a will to live exactly. That certainly exists. What was more striking to me was just the ways in which these men forced what we would think of as emotional relationships, as relationships of responsibility, as family relationships, intellectual relationships, into an environment that was built almost precisely to deny them all those things.
Well, Benjamin Wallace Wells, thank you so much for talking with us.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me.
Benjamin Wallace Wells spoke with Terry last Thursday. His article, The Plot from Solitary, is in New York Magazine. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Yanculli.